you want a vision of the future, Winston, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Someone is trying to teach me a lesson in futility. Why am I the only one who isn't killed?
They will run you dizzy. They will pile falsehood on top of falsehood until you can't tell a lie from the truth and you won't even want to. That's how the powerful keep their power. Don't you read the papers?
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, sir, you.
Plastics.
I'm going to get your money for you. But if you don't get the President of the United States on that phone, you know what's going to happen to you?
What?
You're going to have to answer to the Coca-Cola company.
The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business, Mr. Beale. It has been since man crawled out of the slime.
Welcome to another episode of Our Interesting Times. It's my pleasure to have Jay Dyer back on the show. Jay is, of course, is the proprietor of Jay's Analysis, the author of Esoteric Hollywood, Sex, Cults, and Symbols in Film. He also is a co-host of a new, web-based show. Or is it web? Hollywood Decoded. He co-hosted with Jay Wiedner. Hollywood Decoded. How do people watch that?
It is essentially streaming, but it's also available on some... satellite and cable networks. It just depends on whether your particular service has the Gaia package, and so you can either order it directly through signing up at Gaia's website, or if you're Amazon Prime or your Apple TV or your Xfinity cable has Gaia. I think Xfinity has it, and I think we will eventually be on Comcast as well. So
okay,
there's
good.
All those different means.
Okay, excellent. And you think the first episode just aired, or?
Yeah, they released the first one Monday, and then we will have every Monday there will be a new episode. So there's 23 of those so far.
Okay, that's Hollywood Decoded. Jay Dyer and Jay Wiedner discuss Hollywood, and sort of, I guess you could say it's kind of much like your book, right? Esoteric Hollywood.
It is. It's a little different because several of the first 15 that we did were kind of roughly things that I covered in the book, and then Jay Wiedner's really he's really encyclopedic when it comes to film knowledge, and so he brings a whole lot of insight and information to the table that quite often I'm not aware of. So it makes for, I think, a really interesting. I think Patrick Hennigsen said it was the 2.0 upgrade of Siskel and Ebert. So I think it is a better version, I think, of Siskel and Ebert, because we just cover a lot more interesting ground than, you know, whether it was good or not.
Yeah, not so much the entertainment aspect of it, sort of its cultural and political significance of these films. Yeah,
and for the most part, we weren't really censored. We pretty much could say whatever we wanted, and... I'm very happy with it. Did you get a chance to see that episode?
No, I haven't seen it. I have to see. I get Amazon Prime, so I have to see if I can get it.
As I understand, somebody was telling me that the Xbox and Amazon Prime even though they do have Gaia, for some reason they're like 2 weeks behind on when they update their content. So it may be another couple weeks before it's available on Amazon Prime.
Yeah, I'll definitely check it out. Definitely. Well, tonight I wanted to discuss. You did a recent episode of Jay's analysis of the Tavistock Institute, particularly Daniel Estlin's book, Tavistock Institute: Social Engineering of the Masses. And I thought we'd talk about that for the bulk of the conversation tonight. But of course, a lot has transpired, and you've had some observations regarding the sort of this melee that was stirred up, fomented down in Charlottesville. And of course, this might be an example of such things that that Tavistock mm-hmm. cooks up, as far as this heightening of the tensions, dividing and conquering, and these things, manipulating of the masses. So, what was your take down there on the this clash between neo Nazis and the Antifa anti fascists, as it was portrayed?
Right, well, I think when it comes to the so-called KKK and neo-Nazis, I think there were probably a handful of people who actually have that view present.
Mm-hmm.
And then quite a few more palatable right-wingers, I guess it would be the way to put it.
Yeah.
And so I think that when Trump made his statement about both sides, he was being accurate there.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you know, obviously with the Antifa, we have a kind of Soros-backed radical left group that is just over the top in terms of provocateuring. And so you basically got two, I would say, obviously Antifa has a lot more numbers than the fake KKK neo-Nazi groups. They might have had, I don't know how many. We talked to quite a few people who were at the melee. And the general consensus is that, you know, this was kind of a trap. People were lured into this to basically cause a big disruption and then paint the right of all flavors as all basically, you know, what's the greatest sin in our day? Racism.
Yeah.
The only sin that's left is the civic sin. That and climate, if you offend the climate. And so I think that they granted the city and the judge granted the permit so that it would appear to go on. The police were told to stand down, and this allowed the left to pretty much engage in whatever they wanted to. And so the Antifa and the left, I think they feel like they have the support of the mainstream media, and so mm-hmm. they can go for broke. And that's what happened. So as a result, this was all, I would say, probably crafted to make the right as a whole, you know, look like a bunch of lunatics, even mm-hmm. though that's not actually what happened at the event. I'm saying that the media portrayal was to make it that way. And then all we've seen in response to this over the next few weeks was that very thing. All these people are saying, oh, you know, there's giant swaths of neo-Nazis running around. And so I think I don't buy into this. They're trying to divide us. They're trying to divide us as if there's some sort of generic unity by which we all have that's not already manufactured. Mm-hmm. I mean, the divisions that we have as human beings, if you have a problem with that, which many people do, I think it really suggests that you have a problem with the creator. You know, it's God who created us to be different. And so the root of this idea of hating distinctions and differences is rooted in a kind of atheistic and almost demonic fervor that people think that they're going to stamp out what they perceive to be the enemy, be it white people, be it right wingers or whatever. And this has really been hyped up and concocted and inculcated, indoctrinated through the media and the education sphere. And the way that was done, I think, was done through psychological warfare and through the kinds of entities that we're going to talk about, particularly Tavistock. Tavistock was instrumental in studying originally things like shell shock and PTSD in soldiers. Then it kind of morphed into studying all kinds of things like corporate management structure. And then as a result of all that kind of study, you get a lot of implications for how to manage mass populations. And so that's really what we're looking at here is mass population management and the psychology and the psyops used to steer target groups in the direction you want them to go. And I think that anybody who has any semblance of truth or concern or care for truth, it's patently obvious that we're being steered in the direction of the idea that anything healthy and traditional is racist and is the enemy and must be stamped out. And I think that you could look at entities like Tavistock as really pioneering that kind of idea, because they were saying decades ago that they would promote the left ideology, they would promote the revolutionary ideology of the 60s, that kind of ideology would be promoted, and things like feminism, alternative lifestyles, all these kinds of things. So there's a whole list of this kind of stuff. That's all, and I would say by extension, even though they don't mention transgender, they talk about alternative interpersonal relations and alternative views to identity, right? Which, by the way, is, of course, a blatant contradiction. If identity doesn't exist, then why is there all the obsession over identity politics? Right? Mm-hmm. We're obsessing over a thing that doesn't exist. And so, in other words, all this is weaponized, and it's weaponized to destroy Western civilization, and not just Western civilization, but by extension, all the other, quote, civilizations out there.
Yeah, excellent. I think you alluded to this, these internal contradictions of identity politics. And I had the opportunity to listen to your interview with Patrick Henningsen regarding the Charlotte event. You made a point regarding about this false unity that the our liberal society has. This goes back perhaps to the flawed or experiment that is America, the liberal experiment. You made the point that this liberal society wraps itself in tolerance, and because of that, it can't tolerate intolerance.
Well, this is what Karl Popper, the father of the open society philosophy, himself said.
Mm-hmm.
He was kind of asked this question, and he says, well, it may seem paradoxical and contradictory, but yes, the open society must not tolerate intolerance.
Mm-hmm. it makes for a great bumper sticker.
It does, and of course, we don't. These sort of vague categories, which the establishment, the technocrats, actually like, that doesn't really tell us what it is that's to be stamped out. It just says intolerance. So hate speech and intolerance then become these kind of elastic categories that can be stuck on anything that is that the ruling oligarchs deem to be unsavory, that they don't like. So, I mean, 10 years ago, something like a racial joke is considered, inappropriate. And eventually it becomes hate speech. And then a few years later, California is talking about giving people tickets for not using the right gender pronouns.
That's absolutely insane.
It just spirals into madness.
Actually penalizing people under the force of law to somehow pick among a list of, not two, maybe 10, perhaps 20, perhaps 72 pronouns.
I know that Orwell is overused and oversighted, but I just can't help but continue to come back to the, it boggles my mind, because it's like, how the stuff that O'Brien says to Winston so many times, and with Winston talking about history being revised and having to be restated, and monuments torn down and all this kind of stuff, and books burned, pigeonholed, stuff down the gulag or whatever. Get rid of those books.
Yes. That's why you have this iconoclasm going on in the South, because these statues contradict a narrative that's reigning right now, sort of a current narrative that serves the oligarchs well. Obviously, you can't even entertain that there is another argument during the so-called American Civil War. The irony of Lee's statue being taken down in Charlottesville. Well, it was Lee's military maneuvers in Northern Virginia, or Central Virginia, that spared Charlottesville from being burned down by the Union Army. Mm-hmm. So, and now you have the current, you know, scalawags and carpetbaggers that now control the city of Charlottesville taking down a statue. Because, again, these statues are a introduction or a reminder of a very complex, much far more interesting history that, of course, they're not teaching anymore. So,
what about the terrorism of John Brown? I've never heard anyone talk about the terrorism of John Brown, but when I read histories... And when I studied Civil War, I was like, oh, this guy's a terrorist.
Mm-hmm. That's right. There was a whole Beecher's Bibles where they're, you know, sending rifles in crates marked as Bibles into Kansas to foment bleeding Kansas.
Yes.
You know, stirring everything up. You know, it's, so it's a very complex, like you said, the real history is far more interesting, but yet they want this dumbed down, Mick history, for lack of a better term, you know. Where it's just, it's black and white, it's easy, it's a silly little moralistic fairy tale, and that's all you have to learn.
Well, it's scary because we're beyond the point where you can reason with people. We're getting to the point where you can't have with most people, you can't have a rational conversation about any of these topics, because to have that kind of a conversation kind of presupposes that people have a basic level of education and use of logic to deal with disagreements or, weighing the evidences in your mind and changing your opinion based on facts and evidence. But when a society gets so demoralized that it doesn't even have basic skill sets, I think we're getting past the point of, we're being able to reason with a large portion of people. Mm-hmm. I don't think you can reason with them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in other words, do you think that if you went out, man on the street, and you tried to explain the nuances of the Civil War, how far do you think you would get?
It's tough with people's, increasingly shortened attention spans. How do I put that in 140 characters on Twitter, right?
Yeah.
Right. I try not to be misanthropic about these things, but it's becoming increasingly more difficult because I run up against that a lot. That people can't even have a conversation. A lot of it is they're engineered this way. Perhaps they're shorter attention spans and not taught the history to begin with. It's also fear because they hear something that's politically incorrect, and this is part of the corporate aspect of society. How they fear retribution for politically incorrect thought. And
And there's a kind of entrained emotional reaction to things where you just react without sort of pausing and thinking. And the establishment, and especially their entities like Tavistock, I think they became very adept at the very intricate research that can pinpoint the ways to really set people off. Obviously the state and various governments and operations and military tactics within history, they've known how to do this kind of stuff for a long time, but I think the scientific precision is where we get Tavistock, and it's really out of these kinds of entities like Tavistock that you get the kind of warfare that Brzezinski talks about with the smart warfare, smart power, soft power. It's the same approach to viewing the world and manipulating masses of population through scientific technique is the key here. And so when we read Esalen's book, it just kind of leads us to, I think, other important figures who have all these same views, like Bertrand Russell, like Huxley and Wells, and you know, the kinds of characters that Carol Quigley covers in Treasure and Hope and American Anglo-American Establishment. We get a greater picture of this worldview, and it's really the stuff that you and I have been talking about for, you know, 2 or 3 years now on your mm-hmm. podcast. That really is the dominant ideology here, and I would venture to say that the characterization of some philosophers that it's this Western pragmatism, you know, that's what we're really fighting against here, because pragmatism is relativism. Pragmatism says there's nothing true or false. It's really a matter of what works.
Yeah.
It's which ultimately falls into a kind of will to power kind of philosophy. And you know, this is unfortunately the tradition that we've had so long in the West. And I think that there's this aspect to which it's correct to mention things like Talmudic influence or revolutionary Jewish influence.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's just that, because I think there's also, this is also kind of implicit in paganism itself. Paganism itself is, you know, you can go back and read Marcus Aurelius, and you get the idea that the Roman state is the incarnation of God on earth, basically. It's the closest thing that we have to that. It is the logos on earth, and therefore what it does and what it says is truth.
Mm-hmm.
And really this really becomes, I think, the problem of all empires, is the idea that it is truth. And the only difference between those ancient empires and the empires of today is that I think they become a lot more adept at figuring out how to have a shadow empire that tells everyone that you have freedom and democracy when you're actually probably the most enslaved people in history.
Yeah, that's actually, Dennis Esselin writes about that. That was it Kurt Lewin?
Yes. I was going to mention Lewin and Rees.
Yeah. Now, Tavistock, now, of course, I go to Tavistock's website. I see nothing at their website that says they're doing this. I see. What do they say? They say, the Tavistock Institute of Human Relations applies social science to contemporary issues and problems. It was established as a nonprofit organization with charitable purpose in 1947. Wow, that's, you know, that's pretty benign. The Tavistock Institute for Human Relations is dedicated to the study of human relations for the purpose of bettering working life and conditions of all humans with their organizations, communities, broader societies, and to the influence of environment in all aspects on the formation or development of human character or capacity to conduct research and provide opportunities for learning through experience for this purpose, to publish results of such study and research to train students in or for any branches of the said study. Now, what do you read into that?
So. I read that the people that are going into it are also being studied. Mm-hmm. Because, for example, earlier I mentioned corporate structures and corporate management. Mm-hmm. And now that was a fascinating chapter in Esselin's book, because mm-hmm. you wouldn't necessarily think that when you go to the grocery store and there's the plaques on the wall of the top bagger of the month.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the guy who outbagged all the other grocery baggers to get, you know, an Amazon gift card for $20 or whatever the reward is, you wouldn't necessarily think that that was designed by Tavistock, but that's precisely the kinds of things that they studied. And you say, well, so what? That's, you know, the grocery store baggage guy getting a Amazon gift card because he bagged the most groceries. That's what's wrong with that. That's not the point. The point is that model and that whole almost Taylorism approach to corporate structure was really applied not just to corporate structure, but to things like the military. So a lot of their studies had to do with what can we get guys in military battalions, attachments, and so forth. How can we get them to, number one, do teamwork? So they did a lot of research into groupthink. And wiping out sort of independent thought, what methods work best for that, manipulating people into being willing to die for, you know, some sort of stupid little badge, you know, something like this. And somebody sent me an interesting quote from, I think it was Napoleon, you know, was kind of laughing that that men would die for little dinky little metal badges, that they would, they'd be willing to die for dinky little metal badges. Now, this is the kind of ideology that we're talking about here with Tavistock, which is just this ruthless, ruthless quantification of everything, basically. And that I thought was really telling. But so we're looking at management structures. So what you're talking about at Tavistock's website there sounds very benign and mundane. But a lot of that research, by the way, is private. They don't have to tell you what their research is and what all the things they've researched are. That initial funding, quote, charity, that was from the Rockefellers. So this was not some neutral, benign thing. Now, and a further evidence of that, I think Estolin has a good point or at the beginning of the book when he lists the entities interlocked with Tavistock, and that includes Stanford Research, Rand Corporation, MIT, Palo Alto, Institute for Social Research, Wharton School of Business, Harvard School of Business, London School of Economics, Esalen Institute, the big New Age Institute, Hudson Institute, National Institute of Mental Health, on and on and on and on, and then quite a few Fortune 100, Fortune 500 companies. So he posits, and I think he's accurate here, that one of the major forces behind this Age of Aquarius, 60s revolution, New Age alteration in the culture, you could look at Tavistock, and Tavistock will be intimately connected to MKUltra. It will be tied to the intelligence agencies, the corporate structure, the banking structure, and weaponized culture that we've talked about so many times. You need look no further than Tavistock.
Yes, I think Estlin puts it well here. He says, everything from the New Left to Watergate to Vietnam to the Pentagon Papers to the insane hippies to the anti-war movement to the drug rock counterculture were also pre-planned social engineering projects. And so all this, you know, sort of, it wasn't just history unfolding, events interacting with each other to produce the following event. These things were fomented, if not completely managed, by these outfits like Tavistock. Of course, you also have Rand, you know, which is affiliated. And of course, they also got involved in city management, psychological warfare. I think I interviewed Alex Abaya a couple of years ago, and he wrote the book Soldiers of Reason. And what they got into, and, you know, that wasn't just military. That developed out of the strategic bombing survey of World War II. And it was, you know, and that was the first study of real psychological warfare, the effect of the bombing campaign on Germans, which is applied later to, like, the Phoenix program, you know.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, another aspect of this that people might overlook is the kind of thing that John Adams has talked about quite a bit, and it would be the study of trends.
Yes.
And so Tavistock would be very interested in studying trends. And now, why would that be? Well, it's not just to pick a trend and then kind of an idea. The idea is to foresee trends and then dump on that and then kind of own it and then steer that trend in whichever direction you want to go. So why might that be useful? Well, for example, let's say, and I got the impression that from Stephen Dorrell's big history of British intelligence, he kind of hinted that what British intelligence would do in you know, places that were under colonial rule is that if they felt like the political climate was blowing in a different direction from their puppet, then you don't want to waste your time necessarily investing a whole lot of time in trying to renovate the public image of your puppet character. What you might want to do is go ahead and jump on the bandwagon of where the winds are blowing and find somebody to go and basically buy off before they become big and popular. And so that might be, that's, I'm just saying that's one example of how you might want to master the domain of rising trends to control the future is essentially what we're looking at. So this is where all of the think tanks and the big research foundations and the institutes and what they do and what they study, this is where they're and why they're so interested in trends. You know, a couple months ago when Trump got in, I was reading a whole bunch of the, I think I mentioned this to you, a lot of the big foundations and think tanks. So I was reading a lot of their white papers and their analyses of Trump and all this stuff. And that's what you're looking at, right? So you'll find Institute for Strategic Studies and these different outfits that like Brzezinski's worked for. What are they looking at? What are they up to all day? Well, they're up to this. They're up to looking at where the wind's blowing, where the trends are going, how to manipulate and steer those trends is really what it is. And now that's one aspect of it, which is like the, you know, high level control of society aspect of it. But this kind of research is not just useful to, you know, Lord Rothschild. It's also useful to corporations. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Rand Corporation and Tavistock, that this is where they will farm out their research to different. It's not just, you know, the control structure. It functions on many levels.
Yeah, it's the same way that Amazon will follow what type of books you buy or what products you buy, then base their individual marketing based on your buying trends or your past history. And again, just the fact that you have these think tanks and foundations and universities and even intelligence agencies collecting this information, studying it, it's hard to believe that you're just passive observers, right? I mean, they're going to use it for something,
yeah,
which is social engineering. That's the only conclusion one can draw.
Well, we find a couple of great examples early on in pages 10 through 12 of the book where he talks about Kurt Lewin, who's this psychologist that was brought in the early days of Tavistock. And his job was, his first task was to try to sell a group on veganism.
Yes.
Or moving away from meat towards whole bread substitutes. Now, this is interesting because this is, I guess, back in the 30s or 40s. And this becomes the adopted American diet, quote unquote, I believe under, I had a friend who knew all about all this stuff. And he was saying that it was the 70s, I think, under Carter, when they adopted this weird, or maybe Ford, where they adopted this diet. That you were supposed
the
to
food
eat
pyramid, yeah.
Breads.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, that comes out of Tavistock. And part of that, I'm not saying that the food pyramid was vegan. It's not. But what I'm saying is that it's an example of supposedly how you're supposed to eat. Well, who decided that? Well, they've been studying this for a long time from a psychological warfare perspective. And I just found it fascinating that back at this time, they were already considering how to move people away from meat. Now, you might say I'm reading too much into that, but this is something Plato talked about. Plato said long ago, don't feed the slaves meat because it'll make them strong. Feed them feed them grains and keep them kind of fat and lethargic with a bunch of wheat and bread. So I think they know that. In fact, one of the documents that he points to that was a Stanford research document in the 70s, Changing Images of Man. This is a great white paper for anybody who might be new to the topics of white papers, because there's more depth to this kind of a thing than you might think. And in this one, they actually go back through the history of Western civilization, and they look at things like Greek society and Greek democracy and all the kinds of things that you and I talk about. And the point of that document was precisely to alter man's self-image of himself. So it's not just man's view of the world. The changing images of man, so that it would be crucial in the decades following the 70s and 80s to alter man's view of himself. And they actually lay out all kinds of crucial aspects of how to do that. And that was what I found to be one of the most relevant sections of the book. I was trying to find where his list is, but
he talks about social justice warriors.
And, yes, that section. Yeah. And that was, in other words, that back in the 70s is when they were saying that's where the trends were going.
And it's promoting what we're seeing today. Your remarks about the sort of Kurt Lewin and, you know, the encouraging grains, whole grains, breads, and sort of marginalizing meat, you know, kind of reminds me, there's a movie back in the 60s with Richard Burton, takes place in Haiti, called The Comedians, I think, and takes place, and he's a guy who runs a hotel in Haiti. He inherited from his mother, but, you know, this, Haiti's falling apart, and he's looking to sell, get out. But it involves some of the intrigues of Haitian politics at the time, and he's meeting with a government official. He's acting sort of as a he's introducing these two missionaries, Protestant missionaries in Haiti, into the Minister of the Interior, you know. And the missionaries are talking, and they have a theory that what causes violence in the Third World, as they called it, is the overconsumption of meat. And they were pushing vegetarianism to calm everyone down. And Richard Burton says, well, don't worry. He says, you shouldn't have too hard of a job down here. Why is that? Because 90% of the population can't afford meat. So your job's already done for you. But I remember watching that movie, so, you know, because they tell you that if you put them on a vegetarian diet, they'll calm down. And that's also, I used to have an all-you-can-eat seafood restaurant near here. And you'd go in there, and they just give you bread, and these buttery bread called hush puppies.
Yeah.
And they make you, before they brought out your plate for the all-you-can-eat dish, you know, $20 or something, all-you-can-eat, they just pump you full of this buttery bread, so you wouldn't eat the meat, the good stuff.
Right.
You know, you pay your, so, it's, you know, it's an, you know, it can, it's a marketing strategy, too. But
Yeah, well, there's actually a tribe, this is funny, which I oftentimes bring up with, these people who have this ridiculous view, which, by the way, is being promoted at a large scale now by people in the anarchist movement tied into the green movement now. And this is all being engineered to try to get us to move away from eating meat.
Mm-hmm.
And all these anarchists are idiotic, and they just fall for it because they think that the non-aggression principle of their libertarian philosophy consistently leads to not eating animals. But anyway, there is a tribe in Africa, which is, they're all like 7 feet tall, and all they eat is meat, and they live some ridiculous, you know, they live to be like in their 80s or 90s, mm-hmm. and they can jump over elephants and crazy shit. I'm not joking. It's a real tribe. But my buddy who was all into this and was telling me all this stuff years ago was telling me about this tribe, and I went and looked it up, and I cannot remember their name. Somebody who's into the paleo diet out there, I'm sure, can recall this, but... But yeah, you just go look up this tribe, and they completely that destroys this whole idea that, you know, like eating meat, red meat, gives you heart attacks and all this kind of nonsense. It's just simply not true. And the wheat GMO glyphosate based diet, I think, is, you know, most people are coming to the conclusion that that's why we're having so many gut problems.
Yeah, all the inflammatory and disorders and all that inflammatory, just the inflammation that occurs from all this stuff. Causes all types of health problems, but doctors don't, you know, seem to know or care about. To, you know, it's obviously it's your diet. If you alter your diet, you're going to get away. You're going to lower the inflammation, which is going to improve your health and cause all your organs to function better. Which then, you know, you avoid the diabetes. And but that was back in when they started promoting sugar and sort of framing fat as the problem. And actually, sugar is a big cause for cardiovascular disorder. And the irony is when they produce the low fat or non fat products, they put in more sugar, mm-hmm. you know, but that creates all the medical problems because the same people who own, you know, the sugar trust are the same people who run the medical industry. You know, it's a business plan. It is.
Yeah.
You know,
well, and that's why, by the way, pages 12 and 13 are very important too, because he mentions, as you mentioned, the Phoenix program.
Mm-hmm.
That's mentioned in terms of key psychological operation studies, to control the media. And then this is important that a lot of people don't know, how to manipulate local communities into being controlled. And this would, of course, jive very well with Rosa Corey's work, and where she talks about how they, you know, try to, through the Delphi technique,
yes.
you know, try to talk circles around the people who might question the greening agenda of their local communities, which is happening around here too, by the way. But yeah, that whole section is good because he mentions psyops. He mentions that it's all grounded in scientism. He mentions also the usage of feminism and, I thought, amazingly, the promotion of mania. They actually mention that the promotion of mania on a mass scale could be beneficial.
Yeah, because to keep the majority in a is this a quote from the book? It says, yeah, to keep the majority in a continual state of inner anxiety works because people mm-hmm. who are too busy securing or competing for their own survival to cooperate in any meaningful or effective response, you know, to the oligarchs. So it's trauma, yeah, and that's right. Yeah, I mean, that's what you got.
That jives well with this. Would almost perfectly back up Dave's thesis with the serial killers.
Yes, and this, and the, of course, the Phoenix program, and you mm-hmm. would go in there, and you would either report they'd go out in the massacred village and create this gruesome scene, and of course mm-hmm. here, I think you asked me when we were talking about that if I thought to what extent these stories were exaggerated. And you're right. There's no reason to take for granted that these serial killers were as gruesome or as prolific as the media say they are. We're just reading a news account, so you can't be sure about these things. I did a recent interview with a guy who wrote a book about the Zodiac killer, and his conclusion was it was simply just a concoction of a newspaper and a corrupt local government and police department. And there really is no evidence that a Zodiac killer ever existed. Yet it served a political agenda, which is very interesting.
Yeah. Another interesting aspect that I'd forgotten that Esteline mentions is the idea of working yourself to death, the cubicle life, all that kind of stuff was studied. And this is fascinating. He mentions a period when the industrialists wanted a mass workforce and the idea of unparalleled and unrestrained growth. And so they needed mass labor. But then at a certain point, and they didn't want that anymore. So what they did was they moved out of the never-ending growth philosophy into austerity and the zero growth model, which is where we're going nowadays. Right? The idea that
Club of Rome.
That sort of stuff. Yeah, the idea that growth is now a bad thing. We've got to move into the no growth, zero GDP, zero all of it, zero population growth, ZPG, no production. Right, is the way to solve man's problems. And then another fascinating section, which I heard a long time ago that the Rockefellers took over the unions, but I'd never actually read anything on that. And he has a really fascinating section on how they actually did that, is that they just set up all the labor institutes.
Yeah, it's very simple because you just throw money at it. They control the money.
Right.
They have all the money. They buy help. You can always – every man doesn't have his price, but there's always enough people that do have a price.
You know? Yes, interesting too. B.F. Skinner is one of their front men.
Mm-hmm.
Skinner was a Harvard Rockefeller guy.
I wonder why he's famous.
Exactly.
The same reason why they promote people like Kinsey
yes.
What's that beatnik poet? Ginsburg. Why do we know who this creep is? Why is he important? Yeah. Why is Gloria Steinem important? Has she ever said anything of really any depth or profundity? I've never heard anything. It's all just, it's all rhetoric. It's all bumper sticker level philosophy, which he says.
One of the interesting things too about the unions, I thought was fascinating about how they would get control of the unions.
Mm-hmm.
And he said one of the things they would do on page 32 is that they would do an in-depth ethnography of all the different people in the unions and the leaders and learn all of their weaknesses, even to the point where they would figure out who had mommy issues. And then he said once they figured out each one of these guys' weaknesses, they would just play on each one of those weaknesses, and they basically got all the union leaders on their side.
Yeah, and this is...
That's what he says.
Yeah, this is what Reese called the shaping of the psychiatry... The Shaping of the Psychiatry of War and Psychiatric Shock Troops. They would go out and sort of... Psychiatry was a weapon. It wasn't like there to cure people of their problems.
Right.
It was there to target them.
And it's...
Going back to the sort of this idea of austerity and zero growth, the spreading of the pessimism that was felt. I mean, we went from the 60s and this into the 70s, and I remember feeling some of that pessimism, the gas lines. I remember the gas lines, being late to school because of gas lines and these things. Of course, all this is just... At the time, I'm a 6-7-year-old, I don't know, but it just seems that life... It seems to be like this creating out of control, just this pessimism. And there's an episode in All in the Family where Archie Bunker's going on one of his rants, and that he's calm, but he's sitting in his chair, and he's talking to Edith, and they're talking about the Carters, Jimmy Carter's presence. So it's probably 1977, and he goes, for years they told us, buy this, buy that, electric toasters, electric ovens, air conditioning, don't even tell me about the cars. And all these corporations told us that we couldn't live without it. Now, they turn on a dime and they tell us we can't live with these things.
Exactly. There you go.
But there's even a movie with, what's that guy from Three's Company? John Ritter.
Mm-hmm.
Called America 2000 or something. It's about no one has any gasoline. They're riding bicycles around, and he's president because his name is Roosevelt or something. That's why they elect him. And it's a comedy, of sort of a dystopic comedy about America 20 years in the future or something. And it's all very pessimistic. And there's all remember all the movies. I don't know if you remember all the movies that came out at the time were very
Yeah, they started doing the apocalyptic movies in the 70s quite a bit.
Yeah, running out of gasoline, like even the original. Yeah.
And remember,
Mad Max. Yeah, all that.
Remember that. Engdahl explained that 70s stuff and that gas stuff in the 70s was not OPEC. It was actually Bilderberg that organized all that.
That's the needed oil prices to go up.
Yeah.
This was, of course, the age of the petrodollar and this all this stuff. So it's all about leveraging debt and, of course, negotiating the petrodollar scheme where, Saudi Arabia would just pump its dollars back in the Chase Manhattan Bank or something, or buy U.S. treasuries, keep it all going, the spreading of this this pessimism, and this became sort of a meme or just a theme, and with the Club of Rome, and this holds us the targeting as man as the problem, this environmentalism, man is disease.
Yes,
we get that. So
yeah, and you could never get that without what the changing images of man document talked about, without re-engineering man's self-view, self-image.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where mass media, Hollywood, and education play a big role.
Oh, definitely.
Changing our view of who we are and no longer seeing ourselves. And interestingly, this is what the Royal Society said long ago. They said that the scientific revolution would have the effect of removing man from his pedestal as made in God's image. And no longer would he be viewed that way. No, rather, the earth is, the sun is the center of the universe, not earth. And as a result of that, all of the previous views of the world that everyone had, it all has to be tossed out the window. So what I'm getting at is that the revolutionaries, the real revolutionaries, are the people in the establishment that are handing down the revolutionary philosophy.
Yeah, it's like the revolution from above, like that book by...
yes, exactly.
Kerry, what's his name? Kerry...
Bolton.
Kerry Bolton, yeah. All revolutions are from above.
Exactly.
Behind every Bolshevik is a banker,
Yes.
Paying for it. Revolutions aren't cheap. you got to have someone, meet payroll. So they're there to back the revolutionaries. And we get that. One thing you brought out is also the fact that how they even designed things like news coverage, the idea of the sort of the sentimental news coverage, manipulating our emotions to deprive us of our critical faculties. I thought that was interesting. Because
the human interest stories, those are actually placed at certain... Now, I don't know that everybody at the local news station knows this per se, but they're just following a template, you know, whoever they got it from. But ultimately, the template for the way that local news is structured is totally psychological warfare. Now, I've talked about that for a long time because there are a lot of actually studies on this, the from various aspects. So even WikiLeaks years ago, not that I'm saying WikiLeaks is that important, but I guess from a propaganda aspect there, but a long time ago, WikiLeaks released a psychological warfare manual that was used maybe in Desert Storm or something like that. And I was curious at the time. So this is back when they started, like 2009 or 10. And so I was perusing this psychological warfare manual, and guess what it was? It was detailed instructions on how to set up local news.
I'm sure they wouldn't do that here, would they? They wouldn't do that. It's illegal.
No. But isn't it interesting that the local news instructions, well, they look just like our local news channel, right? Like Channel 4 News, Channel 5 yeah. News. And it was very detailed. It was like how to set the set, how to, even to the point of how the anchor's tie needs to be. Because why would that? Well, it's all based on studies of perception and psychological warfare, like how, you know, if the guy wears this kind of a tie, he's perceived to be a lot more believable. You know what I mean? If he has this kind of a haircut, he's more believable. So that's what it was just news.
Yeah, that was I mean, that was. I remember back when Dan Rather was taking mm-hmm. over from Walter Cronkite in the early '80s, and there was big news: should he wear a sweater under his jacket?
Yeah.
You know, I can just imagine the memos that saying you got to hire, you know, hot babes now to read to do the weather.
Isn't that funny? Yeah, that's a new.
Well, that's funny because society used to be, I mean, for news, you had sort of these sonorous voices, Walter Cronkite telling you yeah. how it is, right? This is the news, and it's very serious, and all of a sudden, as society becomes more sexualized, hyper-sexualized, all of a sudden, yeah. the newsreader is a hot babe, and she's exactly. staring you in the eye, seducing you as she tells you about the car crash, as the song goes, you know, right, these the Don Henley song goes to tell you about a car crash with a twinkle yep. in her eye. And that's, you know, and now I'm watching weather reports and you got this woman in this body tight red dress, this outrageous figure. And she's telling you about a hurricane. I'm not thinking about, you know, the hurricane, you know, and it's like you're just assaulted on every front. You know, and they know it, and there are people who talk about, oh, I love Fox News. Why? Oh, because Megyn Kelly's hot. What? And it's so obvious. I mean, it's, you know.
Form over content. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was so obvious. Even Jon Stewart did a bit on it about 3-4 years ago, maybe longer than that, actually. Mm-hmm. About the hot the different babes at the different stations, how like Fox had the hot Playboy babes, CNN had the serious business babes, and MSNBC had the dirty over 30 look. And there's, you have these hot women, they're 3/4 of their legs exposed, and they're talking about like the Sunni triangle in Iraq or something, and they're and you're like, come on, you know.
Well, this is where this ties into the Future Shock section of Esterlin's book, page 140, 141, where he talks about making the public infantile and bestial.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that really echoes what we were saying earlier in the show, that you can't really have a reasoned conversation with most people over any of these kinds of topics, precisely because the operations and techniques have been so successful in promoting infantilism and a bestial public. Now that's not me being mean or arrogant. This is the way that these people talk about it. This is, you know, Herbert Marcuse, who's mentioned in Esterlin's book. You know, he speaks this way. He speaks, he was talking about the rise of the social justice warrior, mm-hmm. even back in his day. That there would be created this politically correct matrix from which you couldn't really make sense of what was up or down by design. And, you know, Eric Fromm and Adorno, all these characters were also involved in that. We've covered, you know, the Frankfurt School stuff so many times, but, you know, this is where we get the authoritarian personality and the idea that the male father figure in a family, the Western white male father figure, that's the origin of all fascism, right?
Yep, yeah.
So all
healthy families are fascist.
Yeah,
intact right. families. And it's funny because it demonstrates a very sophisticated understanding of human psychology, particularly the differences between the sexes, because really, if you disarm the male psychologically,
mm-hmm.
that society will be easily conquered.
Yeah,
because absolutely. Women by nature are nesters, and they'll collaborate with the, you know, with the winners. And so, in a sense, psychologically, if you deprive families of a strong male role model, a leader, you know, as one might say, is those broken families with, you know, a matriarchy, a broken family with a woman at the head of it, is that much more dependent and weaker psychologically and morally to cope. And that's, you know, I mean, we've seen that now. I mean, if you look around, I mean, it's with those communities that have higher illegitimacy rates, results in female-headed households. It's a high rate of what normal people would call dysfunctional families,
mm-hmm.
you know, which makes society easier. That goes back to that sort of debasement or bestial.
Yeah,
making society more bestial because, you know.
Well, and then, you know, another side of that is the attack on sexuality and gender, which he mentions in pages 96, 97, 98, mm-hmm. 99. And he talks about the many of the, especially amongst the British elite, the prevalence of homosexuality, especially mm-hmm. the many of the Fabians and their group, the Children of the Sun. The Cambridge Apostles, the X Club, these seem to basically just be a bunch of gay guys. And the thing, yeah, he talks about T.S. Eliot, W.H. Auden, D.H. Lawrence, Oswald Mosley, and Huxley. I'd never heard Huxley had a gay lover, but I wouldn't be surprised. By the way, even talks about creating a mass autistic-like public in love with their servitude. Now, that's interesting because Chris came across some interesting theories that the rise of autism might also be part of the plan to create an autistic public or a large portion of the public being autistic to fill these kind of widget making,
yeah,
you know, cubicle jobs, coding,
writing code, yeah, writing code, which is yeah, real tedious, and you have someone,
yeah,
with that, yeah.
But I don't think that it's accidental that a lot of these W.B. Yeats and all these occultic satanic characters are also involved in a lot of this gay stuff with Crowley, you know, and they're really influencing people like, well, Tim Leary.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and Tim Leary is one of the, you know, obviously the popularizer of a lot of this drug revolution stuff, along with a bunch of the other characters. But I mean, in the background of that is Crowley, and Leary was a big Crowleyan, very open about it.
One thing, yeah, the use of psychiatry with John Rollins Reese. He headed the World Federation of Mental Health, which is scary.
Yeah.
But the psychiatry is a weapon to apply military methods to civilian life. Now, of course, the obvious question is, if we are supposed to be living in a democratic society with civilian control of the military, how does one justify applying military methods to civilian life? You know, it's kind of like, who rules who in that situation? But it's this regimentation of society through the promotion of neurosis. Of course, their definition of neurosis is being skeptical towards authority, which is interesting.
Well, I thought that we were fighting the eternal fascist.
Yes.
Yeah, so no, you'll never know up from down in this labyrinth and maze of technocratic left scientism.
He also gets into this whole idea of, well, one thing is the level of control. I mean, you mentioned that this network connecting Rand Corporation to, you know, to the corporations, to the universities. And he writes how most universities are just simply adjuncts of the CIA or DOD or both.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Because you have the foundations, of course, the Rockefeller Foundation, whose stated mission, is to promote the well-being of mankind through our work. Okay, that sounds nice. Of course, we know how foundations, they use.
Well, go ahead. Yeah, absolutely. That makes me think of, this is a case I'd never heard of, Marcus Raskin,
mm-hmm.
University of Chicago radical.
Mm-hmm.
Who was used by McGeorge Bundy and basically ran a fake CIA anarchist group. And the reason I bring that up is because, well, it was a bunch of terror, and then this connects to the Baader-Meinhof in Germany. And then Estulin links that to left environmentalist terror groups,
mm-hmm.
which he's postulates are also run by these same groups. I think obviously that's the case, but I'd never heard of this character. But here's a kind of the stuff that we see with Soros, and it's kind of become popularized now that people are catching on to the women running down the street with their boobs hanging out and then running into the church and saying that they're in a punk band. That might actually have something to do with George Soros, mm-hmm. and not real anarchists or rock and roll. This has been going a long time. I mean, here's an old case of what appears to be a Soros type operation with some University of Chicago 60s guy, Marcus Raskin. And then that makes you think, well, now wait a minute. That's probably what's going on with what's the Weather Underground guy?
Billy Ayers.
Bill Ayers. Yeah. You know, the same type of thing.
Guilty as hell, free as a bird. What a country, as he said. Yeah. Of course, he somehow he evaded prosecution, and now he's apparently ghostwrote some say Barack Obama's book.
Yeah, and then all these people, they're just glowingly worshipped in academia.
Bernardino Dorn, yeah.
And why are all these people in academia, by the way? Why is the American university system housing all of these lunatics that are brainwashing the youth? I can't fathom why people would allow their children to be sent to these institutions.
Yeah, and have them borrow, going to wage slavery, I mean, debt bondage, rather, to wage slavery.
To be propagandized.
To be propagandized and ruined, in many respects. Demoralized, right. And ruined. And it is a shocking thing. Tavistock's, there was talk of Tavistock's objective of spreading moral despair. Of course, that moral despair we talk about, mm-hmm. the Vietnam War and how it led to the drug mm-hmm. culture and counterculture, which was fomented and created. This is trauma, and this was one of the objectives of both Tavistock and the Frankfurt School.
Frankfurt School, right.
And of course, Chris Milligan, your publisher, right?
Mm-hmm.
At Trine Day, he talked about his conversation with his father about the Vietnam War, who he was an OSS, old OSS hand and CIA guy, but he talked about the real objective of the Vietnam War wasn't to prevent the communists from taking over, invading West Coast of the United States from Vietnam, or the domino theory or these things. There was helicopters, of course, to be shot down, sold. There were huge bases to be built, huge military contracts, because a lot of weaponry, hardware was wasted in Vietnam. A lot of lives were lost as well. But it wasn't that. And, of course, there was the heroin trade, big thing, Indochina, and kicking the French out and getting control of the heroin trade. But his idea was it was to create social trauma and to sort of destroy societal generational continuity between, and war does that.
That seems to be what Estulin backs up, is that thesis. And Estulin later talks about that Tavistock kind of designed the idea of intergenerational conflict, right?
Mm-hmm.
Of setting youth against the old fogies.
Mm-hmm. And Chris, and I think John Adams at Hoaxbusters, I think did a show with Chris over there, Kendall. Pretty much, he is, sort of the corporate angle of this, how marketing began in the late 40s and 50s. This is a response to the sort of the demographics, of course, because you had the baby boom, and you had the post-war boom, and you had discretionary income and these things. But they were, in order to tap that money, they created a youth culture that didn't exist prior, a separate youth culture.
Exactly. Yeah. Great point.
And of course, we have the Time Life magazine with the MK Ultra, the May 1957 cover promoting psychedelic drugs. This leading us into the 60s. But you mentioned McGeorge Bundy. He led this outfit called the Institute for Policy Studies. This leftist
right.
outfit.
IPS. Right.
Yeah, but McGeorge Bundy was the guy who sort of he's one of the architects of the Vietnam policy, the Phoenix Project, and he's a new lefty type. But this
yeah, he comes up in Tragedy and Hope too.
Yeah. So and the, course,
I think is, if I recall.
Yeah. But yeah, this is again this controlled opposition. You know, the new left again is a controlled opposition because it's not just controlling the left. The dialectic will make it easier to control the right because there's going to be a reaction to all these long hairs that are that are burning the flag or criticizing America. And that's where you get sort of the politics of the late 60s and early 70s with Nixon and the silent majority. And this dividing everybody, they're polarizing everybody, with this constant trauma, And this goes back to the original observations of Tavistock back to World War One, where shell shock, you subject some of the trauma, you can break them down and rebuild them and kind of mold their personality.
Well, that's what I was going to say, is that this gets into the point that you've made many times in the talks with E. Michael Jones about the breaking down of the older notion of who you were and your cultural identity.
Mm-hmm.
Now it may sound a little contradictory because earlier I was saying, they want to have us all divided against each other, but there was not a real unity. Well, what I'm saying is that there was a process to this, to where they wanted to break down the normative traditional ways of how people grouped together. And then as a result of breaking that down, to offer a new form of identity. So the new ways that you have identity is through either consumerism and the products and the brands that you buy, which that maybe that's more characteristic of the 80s and the yuppies or something, but now it's transitioning into that you choose almost like consumerism, but it's a consumerism of ideologies or just random nonsense that you can pick the gender that you are, and then that is somehow makes up your identity. So what they've done is basically offered this kind of consumerist smorgasbord of ways for you to create and mold your own identity under the guise of so-called freedom, when the freedom that you actually would have would be in your normal identity of who you actually are, like what your body actually is, a male or a female, or who your parents were, where you came from, your real identity and ideology. But all that's been broken down, and they don't want to just leave it broken down. They want to give a new, offer a new version, sell you on a new version.
Yeah, and any restriction or constriction on your choice is fascism.
Meaning, exactly.
I want to identify as the opposite sex, or as even some sort of hybrid creature.
This is actually what some of the left intellectuals are very candid about. They're open about it. I did a talk a couple months ago after the debate with Adam Kogesh, where I dealt with the famous Italian intellectual Umberto Eco, where he has a famous essay about eternal fascism. And you think he's talking about Mussolini or guys with weird mustaches sweating and furiously banging a table or a podium. No. He's talking about the idea that there's objective truth for the consistent, hardcore, committed leftist, revolutionary, et cetera, et cetera. The eternal fascism that they believe that they fight is beyond white men with crew cuts. It's not skinheads. It's the idea of there being objective truth. And that's literally what Echo says. He says, we're in an eternal battle against the idea of there being truth.
Yeah, and if you can't acknowledge basic truth like two sexes, you know, Oh, if you're confused about that, God help you. You know.
Well, this is really why what they've been successful on is selling everyone on relativism.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, I think, the first kind of box that you have to step out of if you want to exit the matrix, so to speak, to use the overused analogy.
And talk about an internal contradiction of relativism. Jeez.
Yes, exactly. I mean, right.
It's like, well, then on what basis are you judging what I'm doing, whatever I'm doing? If you really are a relativist, and again, they're the most puritanical, most intolerant. I'm thinking, you know, the Antifa leftist, you know, that's their role in this dialectic. I'm not going to even...
Obviously, yeah, the right, Antifa, that's kind of the perfect, they're the exemplary version of what the kind of Frankfurt School people envisioned,
mm-hmm,
creating as these kind of monstrosities out there as the foot soldiers. And unfortunately, it's going to keep getting worse until, you know, people are forced to realize that you can't live... Well, I think we're going to be confronted with more and more mania and madness, and it's just going to. It's almost like the mania and the madness is a kind of psychological warfare operation.
Yeah, it goes back to this promoting mass trauma, so no one has a moment to contemplate anything, to think about anything. They're too busy chasing a buck to maintain their lifestyle or to keep falling into poverty. They can't understand what's going on in the world. The world is not that. Complicated. That's the one thing that they've also promoted, you know, modern art, modern dance, exactly. Modern art itself, even music. I think it was Adorno who said that his music is designed to make you go insane. Mm-hmm. You know, art itself, I mean, obviously art is supposed to reflect nature and beauty, verisimilitude, and any fool can walk in and admire and identify a piece of art. It's modern art that takes the experts, and that's to make you feel stupid, that there is no objective truth in the universe, there's no order, it's just all atoms bouncing, you know, materialism, things bouncing off each other.
All kinds of false presuppositions there. Oh, for example, the idea that beauty is completely relative. This is sort of dominates the art world.
Yeah.
Now that's amazing because 300-400 years ago, no one in the art world would have thought that. Nobody would have thought that beauty, which is intimately tied to concepts like symmetry and harmony and form, mm-hmm, that those things could be relative because they're objective principles that you go by. You know, if you construct a musical piece, there's obviously a distinction between something harmonious and beautiful and something dissonant.
Yeah.
But what they have what's mind-boggling is that they've been successful in, through the big money foundations, as you're talking about here, all this funding for MoMA and National Endowment for Arts and all this kind of stuff, they've completely reversed all of this to where somehow the idea became popular or normative that what artwork is somehow it's supposed to be a challenge to conventions, right?
And so, yeah, transgression.
Exactly, and that's sort of the essence of art. And on top of that, the only meaning that it can have is this kind of deconstructionist idea that it's just something totally subjective to the so-called artist. Well, none of that's true any more than, you know, deconstructionism in literature is true. It's not like nobody can understand Dostoevsky, but Dostoevsky, and then everything else is just your imposed meaning upon it. That's ridiculous.
Yeah.
I mean, for one, you know, any of the deconstructionists or these the Wittgenstein-type language game theorists, they all write their books as if they're telling you the truth, which their books themselves would therefore be, you know, contradictory because...
Well, if you engage...
If language is a language game of total nihilistic meaninglessness, then the books that they're writing are nihilistic meaninglessness.
Yeah.
And so this, what I'm getting at here, just to make this all simple, is just that across the board, the problem in every one of these spheres is the left ideology.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying that from the vantage point of neoconservatism or the American idea of faux right. That's all left.
Yeah,
it's not
Mitt Romney versus Barack Obama you're talking about.
No. No, I mean, yeah. Umberto Eco is just as wrong in his crusade against truth as Adorno is, or as Yoko Ono, right? And her, she makes garbage art for MoMA. Like, she just lays garbage out. her idea of what beauty is, that it's totally relative.
Is that the one that the janitor accidentally threw out or something?
It may be. I can't remember, but there was a funny story like that. And then I was watching.
But the janitor said throwing out the art was his own brand of performance art. So he got to keep his job. So.
I remember I just saw some YouTube clip of Yoko Ono, like, and she trailed the garbage outside of the facility, like it went out the door of MoMA and then into the street, and so people were kind of like, you know, do we throw this away, or do we leave the trash here, or what does this mean? And then that reminded me of the old video where John and Yoko are like tripping acid and they're laying on a couch or something, and John swears up and down that Yoko has the ability to control flies, and I'm not joking. There's a fly that lands on her leg, and then the fly literally kind of walks up her body. And John is sitting there saying, like, she can control the fly with a mind. She can do it, mate. She's got the powers, mate. And I'm sitting here thinking, well, she's had this affinity with flies and trash like her whole life.
She may be able to attract flies, but
exactly. Right. Maybe it's just her artwork. It's not really her powers.
Well, that type of nonsense is the whole reason why they flooded the country with LSD, with MKUltra.
Exactly, and Esalen talks about that too, yeah. Which jives very well with, you know, a lot of Dave's work in Laurel Canyon. Mm-hmm. Is you know, he talks about the LSD essentially being a mass social experiment.
And it was gradual. Remember, they first started, you know, dosing people in bars in San Francisco. There was, this was a Midnight Climax
and
George
then,
Hunter
yeah,
White.
And then,
then they started mass dosing with these rock festivals, which are all
Monterey
funded
Pop
by
Pop Festival,
yeah,
right?
Funded by bankers, you know, like the Grateful Dead had the Mellon fortune behind them with Pagan Mellon Hitchcock, and this was also with Timothy Leary hung out there at the mansion there. It's all funded. Of course, Sandoz was owned by the Warburg family, which, you know,
yes. And then
the same
Macy
time, they
also
owned
right.
IG Farben, which I think is interesting. But this Jewish banking family,
right,
controlling interest in IG Farben and also Standard Oil. That whole gets into that whole, you know, what was really going on with the war and everything.
Right.
And it's really, and also, that's, you know, you talk these Jewish neoconservatives, who their godfather is Leo Strauss, this University of Chicago philosopher, you know. But of course, his godfather was
Carl Schmitt,
this Nazi legal theorist.
Right.
It just nothing makes sense if you go by the official narrative of these events. One thing I thought,
well,
was,
that's how the relativism and the nihilism of the left collapses into the will to power Nietzscheanism. And
yeah.
What's interesting is that the post-war Frankfurt School theorists saw this. This is what Horkheimer and Adorno talk about in Dialectic of Enlightenment. They actually say, look, all this feel-good leftism is meaningless. It doesn't work. We've had, you know, two world wars. It's time to transition over into just, you know, Ubermensch world of power stuff. Mm-hmm. Here. Let's just bring the carcasses, bring the necrophilia, and destroy this whole thing.
Yeah, and this is why, what's after the war, what's his name, that Nazi paratrooper is, like, consulting with the Mossad. You know, the guy who saved
Reinhard Galen.
He was another, but the other guy.
Otto Skorzeny.
Otto Skorzeny. Yeah. And he goes, Galen, he's... one thing he mentioned, the Galen Network was... The other ones that pulled off... stirred up the Hungarian Revolution in 56. And according to... where, you know, they're operating in Hungary. Of course, they're left hung out. You know, they're stirred up, then left hung out to dry in 56. And it's funny that you thinking these events are just happening behind, you know, behind the Iron Curtain. It's something that's happening behind the Iron Curtain, but it turns out this is almost like a Soros color revolution at the time.
Oh, interesting.
And he mentions that in the book.
I'm not aware of this. What is this?
This was in. I wasn't aware of these, but Esteland, it was the Galen Network. They're the ones operating in Hungary. To stir up the 56th revolution, you know, with what was his name? Janos Kadar was dethroned, and
I got you.
Nagy, I think, was the guy they brought in for a little while. Then the Soviet tanks rolled in and crushed it, and all this. If I got that right, but one part I thought you might find interesting was he touches on science fiction and UFOs, and the part on Carl Sagan I particularly liked.
Yeah, that a lot of that tied in well with. Yeah. You know, stuff that I've written that was in Esoteric Hollywood, and I thought that meshed well with my book. But yeah, Esteland kind of goes with the he accurately points out that the transhumanist type stuff and the scientism stuff has all been engineered, and that it's not. Well, he kind of takes the same thesis that I do about it being a kind of. You know, replacement religion, and he, you know, he cites Bertrand Russell and all these usual suspects. But yeah, I mean, isn't it interesting that, as he points out, the science fiction, scientism stuff over here on one side with the pop culture and Star Trek and Star Wars and all that. Doesn't that mesh very well with the alterations of the 60s?
Mm-hmm.
And I started noticing this too when the last when I flew back to Denver a few weeks ago, we filmed six more episodes of our show, and one of those was on Star Wars and one of those was on Star Trek. So I was doing a lot of reading on Star Trek and Gene Roddenberry, and I what's funny, and the reason I bring that up is because we think Roddenberry is this hard-nosed atheist guy, and he often spoke and kind of acted that way. Yet at the same time, he seems to have these very Gnostic, transhumanist, almost Luciferian, weird occult views, while he's also espousing this scientistic atheism.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Roddenberry's a good example of how there's this easy bridge between the transition out of the older Americana. I'm not saying that it was good, but you know the ideas of the 40s and 50s into this new age. And you know, John and Chris have talked a lot about how cosmism and atomic art and all this kind of stuff that got popular through the science fiction and the pulp fiction of the 40s, 30s, 40s, and 50s. Then we transition into, in other words, what I'm getting at is that Gene Roddenberry is a kind of a good example of how the 60s is both the cultural, sexual revolution, social revolution, and you have this science fiction revolution. And that may sound unconnected, but it's not, because as Esteland points out at the end of the book, both of those revolutions kind of move us towards the idea of, you know, the coming technocratic transhumanist age.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I'm getting at. I think we can't underestimate the impact of somebody like Gene Roddenberry in Star Trek, one of the, you know, most popular series of all time, and the cultural messaging in Star Trek. And you know, you can throw in all the other sci-fi stuff with it too, but I mean, while I know a lot of people would consider 2001 to be the, you know, the apex maybe of artistic sci-fi, it's certainly pales in comparison to the influence and popularity of Star Trek.
You know what's interesting about Star Trek, though?
It could be many things. What?
The first series, when it ran for 3 years, 1966 to 1969, and it was taken off the air. Then it was put into syndication in the mid-70s, and that's when it really took hold.
Yes, that's actually in our episode, Wiener makes that point.
Okay, because I remember buying the Captain Kirk t-shirt. I had it when I was a kid. I had a Toy Enterprise, a Corgi toy company. You're familiar with Corgi? They make these elaborate cars. Uh-huh. Nice, when you're a kid, it was great. You Corgi, not the cheap crap they produced at Walmart. This was like, go to a local, this one toy stores were locally owned, and they were really interesting to go into because they had these, it just wasn't all corporate. But you'd look behind the glass, and they were a British outfit. But they make elaborate toy cars, and one was an Enterprise my father got for me of the Starship Enterprise. But it became a really big show in the mid 70s, and that's when Trekkie started popping up. Mm-hmm. So I thought that was interesting.
This is an example of this is an example of that replacement identity.
Mm-hmm.
So you're meaning through your tradition and your culture and religion, as you've been given these flimsy, goofy pop culture things.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what he ends with, is this chapter on Tavistock and science fiction that I thought was perfect. I
mean,
it's essentially Jay's analysis type stuff here.
Yeah, and there's also the whole idea of cosmos being huge and vast and sort of the shrinking of man. And this gets sort of this invoking the beyond, which the Collins brothers are writing a book
exactly.
on.
Exactly, right.
The UFO thing is big, the ufology, where it's idea the gods are going to come down, and he mentions Arthur C. Clarke, the end of, was it the Childhood's End, where they, I think they destroy the planet in the end or something. Mm-hmm. But this idea of invoking the beyond and just shrinking of man and significance, and that's what Carl Sagan's, billions and billions. And
billions and billions. Yeah. And
it's not science. It's like it's all mysticism.
That's what I was going to say. We laugh about Bill Nye and Neil deGrasse Tyson and their supposed science shows, and Bill Nye's saying the exact opposite of what he said 10 years ago, that gender isn't biologically determined, and we think that that's strange. Well, he points out that Carl Sagan had episodes about whales singing to the Hindu gods.
Yeah.
Singing whales to Hindu gods. if I recall, doesn't Carl Sagan have a book on aliens?
Yes.
Alien serpents in Genesis or something like that?
Yeah. That's like when you get these scientists, they'll talk about, extraterrestrial life, and they'll say it has to be because the universe is so vast. Well, that's not scientific. I mean, that's...
No, it's not. In fact, I think it's still on Hoaxbusters somewhere, but Chris, somebody sent it to him, or he dug up this great clip, actually, from William Shatner. And it's not the only gem from Shatner in this regard, by the way. There's a really funny one where Shatner is telling a story. I found it on YouTube. It may still be up there. I don't know. But he talks about... that when he visited NASA back when they were filming the old show, that they played a prank on him. And when he was sitting inside what he thought was, the Challenger or whatever spaceship that it was supposed to be, he said he looked out the window and they flew a Enterprise by the window somehow with some effects or trickery. He said it freaked him out because it looked so real. And he said, Shatner didn't come out and say that the moon landing was fake, but, he said something to the effect of, "My God, if they could do that, what else could they do?" Now, there's another great clip where Shatner's at a convention and, he's signing autographs or something, and somebody comes up to him and says, "Blah, blah, blah, what do you think about what Stephen Hawking said about the black holes and how the black holes have this density and blah, 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 blah?" And William Shatner says, "You know what I've learned after all my shows is, it's just as much Star Trek that they're talking about." He's like, "They're talking about the same crap we talked about. They're just making it up."
Well, you can, because, who's going to hold them accountable? I mean, you're talking about all this stuff about, I don't know. How do you test it? How do you test that?
Right.
Black hole theory and, these things. It's, but that's one thing is the... if you, it is a show, and that's one thing I was talking recently, just talking about the moon landing itself, how elements of it. I don't know, but I'm skeptical because the information we've been given is very poor. All I know is we've never really gotten evidence. We saw a production, and then we're told that it's real. Okay, but if you really scrutinize it, like, you know, like a dune buggy on the moon, is that really? Come on. And dune buggies were popular in 1970s, so
made it really.
Yeah,
Dave's book made it really comical, and so it's just kind of like, you know, I don't have a problem with aerospace technology, or I think satellites are real, and I think rockets are real, but you know, anybody I think with any common sense and just sort of basic logic can read Dave's book and look at the different claims that we've had from all these characters, and we can at least come to the conclusion that what we've been presented with these, you know, hole in one golf games on the moon is obviously nonsense.
He snuck a golf club on, you know, and he's playing golf on the moon. It's, you know, it's a dune buggy. I was talking to I think off call. I was talking to Andy Nowicki about that, and I said I wouldn't be too surprised if, you know, they had formed a band up there, because back in the early 70s, everybody was in a rock band. You know, if they have a dune buggy, why not have a rock band too up there? It's,
well, they're all a bunch of Masons. They wouldn't lie, right? Buzz Aldrin wouldn't lie about any of that. They're good old boys that tell the truth, right?
Yeah, well, yeah, that's right. They, officers have to. It's officer code. So, but that goes back to, again, if you're talking about Tavistock, the psychological warfare, this is exactly that type of operation they could pull off because of their control of the media, and, you know. CBS News, Walter Cronkite, you know, it's all seeing eyes telling you the truth. Okay.
Yeah. Right. And and Esalen, of course, he did include, you know, the section that kind of covers stuff that the origins of NBC, CBS, ABC, and the OSS with the Sarnoff and Paley and all those characters.
Yeah, just do it.
And you know, RKO being owned at one time by Rockefellers, and then Kennedy, and what's his name? In with the Mormon Mafia.
Oh, Howard Hughes.
Howard Hughes, yeah.
Yeah. Oh yeah, and I think in your episode of Tavistock, you include that video from the from Lookout Mountain, right?
Oh yes, yeah, right. I forgot. Somebody posted that in one of the Dave McGowan groups. They'd found a old archive footage of a whole bunch of stuff from Laurel Canyon, from Lookout Mountain, which was fascinating because it basically, you know, vindicates all the stuff that Dave said. It was all kind of. They even showed the promos of you know, Jimmy Stewart being there and him promoting some. I don't know, some training video or something, but it was a lot of the you know, the big actors of that time, you know, the stuff that Dave claimed vindicated in that archive footage.
Yeah, and because that gets the whole, and you get into that in Esoteric Hollywood as the sort of the tie between intelligence and military and Hollywood, and Disney being taken over by the War Department during the Second World War, and I have to imagine they never really quite let free of them. Of course, the whole Disney operation is probably, you know, goes back to Freemasonic origins. You know, it's the whole it was never that.
You know, this stuff is so obvious now, and I still get people who get really mad when I talk about this stuff. I get people commenting, you know, really angry comments about this kind of stuff, and it's just like, you know, the idea that there could be this long time connection between Hollywood and the intelligence agencies. You know, it's still.
Well, because Hollywood
really rubs people the wrong way. Like, why does this make you so mad?
Because Hollywood's full of liberals, and the CIA's full of like right wingers, I guess, in their worldview.
Is it really? I mean,
yeah, you know, maybe, or the military is. I don't know. It's just that they're.
Yeah, maybe the military. Yeah,
but the whole idea that the you know, they make movies that are critical of the military sometimes. You know. Yeah, you know, that appear to be critical, but they're really not. You know,
they appear to be. That's interesting, but yeah, the there've been a lot of people who've kind of shown that's not actually true, and we still get a lot of these recruitment type movies and propaganda movies pretty regularly.
Mm-hmm.
So I think they don't really care about necessarily the betrayal in this or that movie, as long as overall they have kind of the say so, which is basically what the more academic books that were written on that topic have said, like Operation Hollywood.
Mm-hmm. So, and obviously something as important as Hollywood, even if it's radio or TV news, the powers that be aren't going to take a laissez-faire approach to these things. It's going to be controlled. It's all corporate.
Right.
You can draw out the corporate connections and the connections to the intelligence agencies, the oligarchs that control things in film. There's too many examples. Obviously, we can't get into them here, but,
well,
I mean, just do the research. I mean, cursory research should tell you that. So.
Right, and another thing that that this kind of conversation, I think, one of the reasons it makes people angry is that it kind of undercuts a basic assumption that a lot of people have, that there's this, that there's the public sphere and the private sphere.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, if for example, a lot of libertarians will find this discussion distasteful, because for them, the real battle is the individual creative entrepreneur fighting the tyrannical state. And so what we're talking about really doesn't fit anywhere into that model, because the idea that that there's a lot more collusion between these entities, and that we actually live in kind of a public-private merger, right?
Yeah, it's a public-private partnership.
Yeah,
right. The New World Order is a public-private partnership.
It is, and that's the recent talk that I did today. Well, actually, last week, and then the addendum today is on Quigley's other book, Anglo-American Establishment, which he actually lays all that out. And one of the things that I thought was really interesting was that he talked about how there wasn't, for the Milner Group or the Rhodes Group, Royal Institute Group, there wasn't really any care or concern or perception of anything like that. In other words, the revolving door phenomena, mm-hmm. is what was going on even then. And he talks about how, the guys that they would be editors of the Spectator or the Times, and then they were also on the board of Oxford, and they're also on the Royal Institute for International Affairs, and they're also on the board of some big Dominion, one of the corporations in the Dominions of the Empire.
Yeah.
Like they're head of the tin, the copper board or something like that. So revolving door, and another interesting aspect to that, which we see continued in the U.S. Empire, is the notion of key men and key positions. So they don't really have to worry so much with controlling every single aspect of society or every single person, as long as they are in control of who has key positions, which mm-hmm. I thought was a very insightful thing. So what they were more interested in than, they didn't care about running every educational institution in England. What they cared about was running Oxford.
Yeah.
Running Cambridge, right? Running the London School of Economics. And a central aspect to all of that was who had the certain chairs of certain departments of the universities. And that's absolutely true still today in the U.S. system.
Yeah. And with this, what they do is they create an arena, as long as we're playing within that arena, and they can be various,
left, right, nobody cares.
Yeah, but they're in that arena, and that's fine. That's what it is. It's creating an arena, that arena. That's what this whole, that's what the whole Rhodes Roundtable thing was a creation of, the whole notion of, I think Kevin Cole gets into this, sort of this whole international relations as a discipline was a creation,
yes,
of the Roundtable.
It is.
These are the rules.
That,
yeah.
That degree. And it's the League of Nations is the Roundtable. That's the model for the League of Nations, Quigley says. So what was that supposed to be? Well, just basically a debating society to coerce. They don't have a standing army, but it doesn't matter. They have a standing army of money printers called bankers. Mm-hmm. That's their standing army. But you know, could talk these people into to what is quote civilized. And that was interesting, because that comes up a lot in the book, is you when you read the speeches that the different Milner Group characters would give, it's so just sort of infantile, just really empty propaganda. It's like, you know, it's like Germany is bad because they're not civilized over there, and they have the taint of Eurasian despotism in them.
That's right.
And it's like this is how they're convincing everybody to go to war. It's basically saying they're bad. These guys are bad. They're mean. It's yeah. really just infantile, just, you know, sixth grade level propaganda. But that's how it works.
And he gets Germanophobia of the British establishment, how they hated German industry, and how they sort of how they blame German industry for the rise of Hitler, but they don't talk about sort of the Cliveden set's role in promoting Hitler and international British Bank right. of England and these things, and the sort of the financial intrigues that led to the collapse of the German economy in the 1920s.
Yeah, the dual policy, yeah. the appeasement policy, right?
Mm-hmm. And the trauma that they inflicted on German society would produce a Hitler. You know, they wanted that reaction. You
know. Well, that's why Orwell is correct when he says that for all of their glowing statements about liberty, equality, and fraternity, these people are completely duplicitous, because they are the most tyrannical oligarchs imaginable.
Yeah,
that's
and if
the
you think
point
about
of
it,
1984. Yeah. And he's talking about the Milner Group. He's talking about these people.
And if you look at the slogan, liberty, equality, fraternity, all those things are contradictory.
They are. And a lot of the, you know, Lord Lothian and Lord Curzon and Lord Balfour, they would get Lionel Curtis, they would all give these speeches, and they would give their roundtable presentations. By the way, Kuhnhof Kalergi presented his plan to the Royal Institute. Now, we're never told if that plan was actually used, but it looks to me like it has been.
Well, that's used
so that,
to, yeah,
is, that yeah, is not yeah. just a conspiracy theory. Quigley actually backs it up.
Well, yeah, you have the current migration crisis, of course,
exactly.
which tends, but you have the whole, which is the Tavistock program, the EU thing, was grew out of the European Economic Community, which is
well,
the Bilderberg.
It's the Royal Society that dreamt up the EU, Quigley yeah. says.
And of course, it was another yeah.
Well, the Royal Institute, excuse me.
Yeah. But this whole idea, again, of this using migration, integration, diversity.
Oh, there's a great quote by, it may be, I think it's Lionel Curtis, or one of these characters on that very point, where he says, look, make no mistake, our version of the coming world commonwealth has nothing to do with saving British skins. but of creating a more humane democratic world order.
On their terms.
Yeah. Democratic but I just, world. I thought, yeah. I love the
saving British
candidness state. Of that, that, oh, I don't give a shit about Britons. We're not here to say, we don't.
Well, that's why they sacrificed so many in on the Somme.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
These were the proles, proletariats or proles are going to go out and die. Die in the hundreds of thousands, if not millions. And same thing applies to Americans. It's not about saving American skin or American, like, you know, yeah. Americans think that, you know, their military's there to defend our way of life, whatever that means. If it's just some sort of, we have a way of life that's God-given or something.
What is that now, trannies?
Yeah.
Is that
abortion
the
and
new American way?
Right. Yeah, yeah. Abortion on demand, transsexualism, speciesism is next. I mean, this type of nonsense, it's really, yeah. It's, again, I mean, yeah, it really is something else. That's all planned out. And then Chris Curtis was the one that came with the idea of the Commonwealth, right? From the Minions?
I believe that's right, yeah.
Yeah. Sounded just more progressive, I guess, the Commonwealth.
Yeah, he does argue that the name needs to be changed for publicity purposes, which so in other words, Edward Bernays wasn't the first person to figure out that
changing names.
Defense Department is a more a nicer name than War Department.
Yeah, it's funny, because when we had a War Department, we actually had times of peace. Since we moved to the Defense Department,
it's perpetual war.
Perpetual war. You know? It's become a way of life, an economy, and everything. So that's what they want, though. Constant strife, constant trauma.
Well, another important point I wanted to mention that I mentioned today in today's talk is Quigley, interestingly, for this, you know, important historian, has absolutely no place for organized Freemasonry in his works. Now, why would that be? I mean, I know that every one of these characters, all these lords and their minions, largely are Freemasons, mm-hmm. many of them. And this plays no role in Quigley's analysis, yet we have, of course, academic books, which I just got a hold of, the what's her name, Jacobs, the
Jessica Harlan Jacobs, yeah, Builders of Empire,
yeah, that one,
yeah.
Where is Quigley on this, by the way? But what is the credo of Masonry? Liberty, equality, fraternity, Albert Pike says.
Mm-hmm.
And what is the credo of all of the Milner group? Liberty, equality, fraternity, according to Quigley. So now, what does that do? Does that mean they're all occultists? Well, actually, get this. This is another thing I didn't know. Many of them were fundamental in Christian Science, which is Mary Baker Eddy's weird cult, where they think that you can just heal yourself with your mind, and mm-hmm. You can't use doctors. It's really stupid. But many of the Milner group got into this cult, and Quigley gives the impression that they really believed it. And also, I should mention, by the way, levers of control. Can't forget the Church of England. They were always in control of Archbishop of Canterbury. And by the way, one of their chief guys was Cardinal Manning, of all people. I would not have thought Cardinal Manning would have been involved in that, but he was apparently a big believer in the Cecil Rhodes philosophy. Now, I'm not saying that makes Cardinal Manning necessarily a Mason. I mean, he could have been, who knows, but I guess his loyalties weren't with Rome, apparently.
Well, it could have been compromised. I mean, I've heard things about Spellman,
right.
In New York,
exactly, right.
How, what's his name, who's that guy with McCarthy? Rory Cohn had the goods on Spellman, according to Rothstein, the detective,
right.
Rothstein. Human compromise is a big thing, and of course we've had the the apparent Freemasonic infiltration of Rome.
So you're telling me that the Royal Society and the Milner Group, that they would actually compromise somebody? Surely not.
Well, I mean, you've talked about this before, how the thought about, it's like the Russian Orthodox Church that was infiltrated, utilized by the Soviet regime, which it was.
Sergianism,
yeah.
Right.
And of course, you sent me that remarkable picture of that icon where the saint is stepping on the red bishop.
With the Soviet pants underneath his cassock, right?
So at least there's some consciousness of that in Russia. Mm-hmm. Whereas here in the United States, we still have this illusion that the organized religion is somehow acting independent from the state. It's been largely defanged. There's no church militant here in the United States, whether it's through compromise or through tax exemption threats, losing a tax exemption, these things.
Yeah.
But we've had Cardinal Cushing was the other one with the Kennedys.
Yes.
Many
of those big cardinals would be key characters to get a hold of. I did, by the way, go ahead. I finally got David Wenhoff's book on John Courtney Murray. And
oh, yeah, I have that book, yeah.
The Time Life. And,
it's a
I heard your interview, and that's what made me get it. I haven't read it yet. But
it's like a 30-page summation of each chapter in the beginning of the book, which is great.
Because
I love when people do that, because you can read the book, then you go back and read the summation, and it just really organizes your thoughts on a long book. But I'm saying this sort of infiltration of churches, this not something that only occurs in the bestial East.
I mean, everybody, you mentioned Richard Burton. I mean, have we not seen the famous movie Thomas Becket with Richard Burton? I mean, this is a classic. This is called the Investiture Controversy, back in the 1100s, the Church of England, when this was the big problem. was. I mean, this has really always been the problem in many ways, you know, at least after several centuries of the church, I guess, maybe not during the period of persecution, but after the church became more acceptable in the empire, you know, this became the new problem, was simony, investiture.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and Jesus and the apostles actually warn of that. They talk about hirelings, and you have the idea of simony. Yeah, that I still love that movie with Richard Burton and
Peter O'Toole. I like how the end Harry uses the death of the Archbishop to legitimize his rule.
Yeah, I mean, that kind of tells you what the dangers of the state running the church here, and and of course that's always the criticism of the East and the Orthodox Church. But of course, as you pointed out, which I think is fair, is that I don't think that's really a thing that's unique to the East. I think that this is really kind of a problem for the church everywhere, is that you're going to have these state entities that are going to try to want to co-opt and control this, you know, for their own purposes.
And ultimately the states are controlled by the oligarchs.
In our days, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I don't have any evidence that, you know, Thomas Becket was, bankers, but
yeah.
But nowadays, yes, and now that we live in the world of Homo economicus, as Spengler said.
Which goes back to the whole idea of this ideological presumptions. You know, or just ideas, how this dominant view of economics how it justifies all, you know, all these things, whether it's the wage slavery and these things, and the market is prime. Of course, the market's manipulated. There's no free market. I was listening to Chris and John talk about art and how he would like to live in, and Chris was joking, he'd like to live in art where there's a law that says someone had to buy his artwork, his graphic artwork. So it'd make things easier, he admitted it. He says, and then libertarians would say, people just aren't interested in art. They prefer McDonald's over to art. So they'll spend more money on Big Macs and Happy Meals than they will on your art. And that's the market. What are you going to do about it? He says, but what he's not considering is that people have been engineered, or they haven't been instructed on the importance of art in the schools, in these things. These things aren't being encouraged, but consumerism is being encouraged. So,
yes.
People do not have an interest in art, in fine arts, and music, you know. And the one thing to forget is that culture, our taste, well, Bernays said it, right? Our thoughts, our habits, our tastes are controlled by people we never know. And
we've never known, right.
And without that consciousness, you think that you are making a conscious decision yourself. You're not. You're being manipulated. And, you know, and that just takes just beneath the surface, and you'll see where the levers are being pulled, where you're being manipulated through the culture. I mean, it's not as if our educational institutions, or the media, are keeping us educated and informed so we can make the right decision, right? That's not happening. I don't think I'm being too cynical that our education institutions, our media, the news, the legacy media, the newspapers, whatever, they're not designed to edify us, to make the best of us. They're there to manipulate us, to turn us into consumers, cannon fodder, so we can be sheared and slaughtered every other generation.
Well,
right?
The summation of what you're saying and kind of the whole talk tonight and much of what I've tried to do over the last 10 years and things I've studied and written about is that you have the institutionalization of revolutionary philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
And the revolutionary philosophy that was sold to everyone as freedom is actually a greater level of slavery. And it's based on enslavement to baser desires.
Mm-hmm.
And we, in terms of all media people who look at this, that we are the ones who are kind of figuring out just how deep and prevalent these ideas are, you know, with mm-hmm. books like the Tavistock Institute and I keep coming back to what Huxley says in his essay at the beginning of Brave New World, where he says that you have to understand that the Brave New World, the total technocrat society, that is the climax of the revolutions.
Yeah.
And he's talking about all of them, you know, back to arguably even the Protestant Reformation, the Enlightenment, and so forth. The culmination is the technocracy. And so it's just very sad, ultimately, I think, that we are, when we cut ourselves off from the transcendent, we then become kind of prey to sinister forces, I guess is the best mm-hmm. way to put it. Be they the state, be they spiritual, be they international finance or whatever, that they can really manipulate us. And that's why they were so vehement on the cultivation of materialism and relativism, which, mm-hmm. which sort of go together. Because then the people have no, excuse me, they have no bulwark in their worldview, their reasoning process, to keep them from being led down these Pied Piper paths, which are self-destructive.
Yeah,
is what it all amounts to.
Yeah, having sort of ethnic consciousness, traditions, these things. That's just why they're being destroyed.
Well,
yeah.
A great example that you've mentioned many times would be abortion. You know, it's sold as freedom, or it's toyed with as a thing. Oh, we'll weaponize this, you know, for the black community. And then, you know, what happens? Well, you basically unleash this on everybody.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And once that's, you know, once that's out of, loosed upon the world, you know, what do you got? You know, and the philosophical, not just the carnage that it creates, but of course the philosophical corruption that inevitably follows in its wake, because it has to justify, you know, infanticide. You have to, you know, dehumanize the natural reduction that occurs, because obviously mm-hmm. you're dehumanizing a sector of humanity which all of us go through to be here. You know,
yeah,
you
true.
Know, so, and of course the sexual perversion that follows that, because obviously you're further decoupling life from the act that brings life, makes life possible. And if you make the recognition that it is indeed both unitive and procreative, it not only restricts, prescribes proper restrictions on that behavior, but also it keeps you rooted in sort of the reality of it. You're creating life, which you're partaking in the creation of a human life that's going to need to be cared for. And you better be in a position to take care of it. And that's going to, you know, create a situation where most kids are, you know, are cared for, you know. And obviously, if you preach freedom and these things, and I think you and I both talked about this, this was foreseen by Planned Parenthood. This was foreseen by the think tanks, mm-hmm. that if you preach
right.
sexual liberation, you create, society will devolve or unravel, and you create all the trauma, all the problems with the second and third generations proceeding from the broken families would be that much more vulnerable, easier to control. As E. Michael Jones said, you just go to the gay disco and just forget your troubles, you know, because you have no sense for posterity, because you're not forming families, you know, you have no
right.
interest. It's just about you. It's narcissism on steroids.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And without a sense of posterity, that's when you go into the death culture, and that's where you get into the depopulation, sort of the misanthropy that was behind all this stuff, you know.
Yeah, that makes me think of the where does that leave you? Well, basically nihilism.
Yeah.
And, Father Seraphim Rose's book on nihilism is actually a really good critique of that. That's actually converted a lot of people.
Yeah.
No, I've talked to a lot of atheists and nihilists and people like that have read that book and kind of renewed their views on the possibility of there being a God and so forth. So,
mm-hmm.
so there's always a bright side to this kind of stuff. It doesn't have to be
no,
totally nihilistic. And
it's having children is it's an introduction to humility, and also it's the most entrepreneurial thing a human being can do. In many respects.
What is? What's that?
Having children.
What'd you say?
Just having children.
Oh, having children.
It's a mark of faith.
Well, you know, I didn't...
You know. Hello?
Yeah, it's sad that you don't really realize how damaged you've been in this kind of a culture until you get older. You
know, yeah, we're all damaged.
I don't have any kids, and, you know, but you don't realize that, you know, until you get a little bit of time under your belt, and you know, you can kind of step back and look at the world and look at these things, and you realize that, man, this is, you know.
Oh yeah, I mean,
I've been affected by that. I didn't know I was affected by this.
Well, we're all affected. We're all damaged goods, as the that play that Bernays, mm-hmm. I think, promoted called Damaged Goods. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because none of us are immune to the Masonic modern world.
Well, but I think that with your generation, as opposed to the younger, you know, and then as it gets younger than me, I think it gets progressively worse, because the things that they're having to deal with, just kind of, I mean, when I was in high school, there was no one openly gay.
Yeah, you'd be, yeah, it just, that was something you did in college.
and now I see purple haired freaks everywhere. And it's just like, what has happened in the last 15 years? It's like a totally, it's like wake up in a Mad Max dystopia, you know, with all these people with mohawks and stuff.
Yeah, but, and you actually think that, that this is actually something that a teenager should be coping with, or this is healthy and they're happy. And but this is the product. You remember, what's that memo in 1969? Where was it?
The Berylson memo.
The Berylson memo. Yeah. Well, this is foretold, because obviously, if you, mm-hmm. the sexual revolution is going to create, you know, divorce, then the generation that comes from the mm-hmm. divorced families are going to be higher rates of trauma, sexual abuse, and these things, confusion, and, you know, absentee fathers and these things. And, you know, this isn't as if I'm pointing at some family going, you're a broken family, or you're, I'm not pointing fingers at everybody. I'm just acknowledging the fact that they, the people that mm-hmm. that fomented this situation, were acknowledging that reality and producing the psychological
Absolutely.
Warfare
yeah.
to bring it about. You know, whether it's Playboy magazine or, you know, TV shows that promoted, you know, single parenthood, these things like One Day at a Time and all these shows. This stuff isn't just random, you know. It's,
I forgot about One Day at a Time. I used to watch that, like, during the day.
Yeah, 4 o'clock in the afternoon?
But I hate that show. But
I hated it. It was depressing.
Yeah, but it was on. It was.
It's like, yeah, they'd rerun them, like, by the late 80s, they were showing 4 o'clock in the afternoon for kids to watch. That's mm-hmm. great. You know.
And, yeah, and not too long after that, I was raised by a single mom, so.
Oh, well.
Yeah. Yes, it was prophetic in a way, but. Anyway, it was one other thing I was going to say. I forgot what it was, but, so if anybody's interested, I most recently have done a couple talks on the Anglo-American Establishment book by Quigley. Mm-hmm. And people should really thank me. You should really be happy and appreciate me, because let me tell you, Carol Quigley is not fun to read.
Is it easier to read than Tragedy and Hope? Because I have,
believe it or not, I was more interested in Tragedy and Hope than this book. This book is one of the most boring books I've ever read. It's worse than Tragedy and Hope, because so much of the book is him just listing all the people's connections and boards that they were on, and I just. For a while, it was going crazy. This book is so boring. So you should thank me, people out there that you know, for whatever reason, don't like the work that I do. I'm reading these really boring books for you and summarizing them. So it has a function. I'm helping you here.
Yes,
you're not missing anything.
Last year, you did the monumental task of reading this huge tome by Carol Quigley and analyzing it in a way that I have not yet seen done, which was excellent. Of course, we did a number of talks on those. Now you've finally dived into Anglo-American Establishment, which isn't quite as long, what I understand.
No, it's only 300 pages, yeah. And you know, it's not a hard in the sense of it takes a long time to read. I just read it in a couple of days, but it's just very boring, mm-hmm. and it's more boring than Tragedy and Hope. But it's relevant and important, because it kind of zooms in on the characters that are running the show in the background in Tragedy and Hope, which he talks about here and there, kind of in passing. He'll mention them, you know, this Atlantis establishment, mm-hmm. but this book is basically zeroing in on them. and talking about how they ran their empire and how they infiltrated society. I'm not, there's a whole chapter on infiltration and how they saw fit to infiltrate various aspects of society to run the show. And he ends it with this very negative, almost like he's disillusioned, like he can't believe that this, the liberal imperium, the liberal world order failed. He's like, it just, it ground down to ashes. I can't believe it. And, you know, well, sorry, Carol, but the whole foundation of this is ashes and deception. So I can't say that I'm surprised that it ground down to disaster. But, you know, he ends the book basically with it picking up in the American sphere. So the Milner, I mean, in many ways, obviously the Royal Society and Oxford and these kinds of entities in the City of London, they still have a lot of power. But it really kind of shifts into, you know, the American century. It shifts into the Rand Corporation and MIT, and because America becomes the dominant military and technological power.
And this is something they acknowledged, I think, back in the turn of the 20th century, because that's, you had this, the Union Now movement and the attempt to sort of reintegrate the United States into the Anglo fold, right? With the Pilgrim Society and all that.
Yeah, Carol Quigley, or excuse me, Cecil Rhodes listed four goals, and that was number one or two.
Mm-hmm. And of course,
reintegrate America.
Obviously, they were at least partially successful, because look at the two world
they
wars.
They were. Yeah. I mean, they were, and that's because the American establishment linked up with them. The Carnegie Foundation donated a whole lot of money to the Royal Institute for International Affairs. One of the inner circle of the Milner Group was Jerome Green, who was the Rockefeller agent. A lot of money came from J.P. Morgan to the inner coterie. Mm-hmm. So it's the same establishment, and hence Quigley's title.
Yeah, and both Morgan.
But I'm just saying the shift kind of after World War II moves from London kind of to the U.S.
Yeah, the overt empire.
Right.
Yeah, whereas the U.S. became the vessel for these for these Venetians, right?
Yeah, for the bankers and
the bankers
and because
if you
yeah elite.
Because Morgan and Rockefeller both link back to Rothschild, which you could say Rothschild is kind of like the British Empire. You know, you know, that's how one way you can interpret it, because they were the creditors of the Spencers and the Churchills, the political, the functionaries who were up there.
Yeah, there's a funny quote in Quigley where he's not saying that Churchill was some rebel or outsider, but there's this quote where where Churchill figures out that there's this shadow group running things. And he's like, I thought that we, you know, lived in, we had a parliament and all this stuff. And he's like, but something tells me that there's a shadow group that runs this stuff.
Yeah, they have all these quotes from various leaders, supposed leaders, like Woodrow Wilson said, he said some odd, of course you have, who was it? It was, Disraeli said the same thing.
I was going to say Disraeli says it, yeah.
Yeah, and he was good friends with Natty Rothschild, so he should know. Mm-hmm. So, okay, well, yeah, you're going to do the second talk, so perhaps later next month I'll have you back on. We'll talk about that.
Yeah, in fact, now that I have a little more free time, my plan is to really get hardcore. We're going to buckle down. We're going to do some Bertrand Russell. We're going to do some Arthur Kessler. We're going to do some H.G. Wells. We're going to do some Arnold Toynbee. You know, we're going to get into some serious books that maybe even some Charles Galton Darwin.
Mm-hmm.
So I haven't seen anybody else really tackling these book by books, but that's my plan.
Okay, it's the Jay Dyer, Jay's Analysis, jaysanalysis.com, though he's able to do this through the support of his subscribers. And so if you do... get something from his work, I encourage you to support him. It's only what, a pittance, $4.95 a month, $60 a year.
It is a mere pittance. Yeah,
yeah, for a veritable treasure trove of information.
Yeah, $4.95 a month, $60 a year.
Yeah, and do that.
And you can still purchase my. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, jaydnass.com. But yeah, obviously, yeah, your book.
Yeah, you can still purchase the book. It's still selling good. I mail out copies every few days, so. If you want a signed copy of Esoteric Hollywood, you can get it at my site, and you can also sign up and watch Hollywood Decoded.
That's right.
Rave reviews. Everybody likes it so far. And so
you're saying Amazon should, Prime should have it like in a week or so? Is it like a lag time?
I don't actually. This is just what people are telling me. Okay. Is that, well, that Gaia is updated every couple weeks on Amazon.
Okay.
And but of course, if anybody really wants it, they can just go subscribe, and I don't actually know how much Gaia is. I think it's less than Netflix. I don't really know, but
okay.
The shows are varying in length. Some are 30 minutes, some are 45 to an hour, and they go pretty in depth, so they're not milk toast or watered down. They're pretty serious stuff.
Okay. Well, great. Listen, Jay, I want to thank you for coming on and spending so much time with me tonight.
Thank you.
And we'll talk relatively soon, I think, because once the Anglo-American series was episode was very interesting, and I think I'll look forward to the second one, and I think it's a must, because considering all the talks we had about tragedy and hope last year, and I think this is sort of the a great way to finish up on Quigley.
Right. Yeah.
So,
okay.
So listen, great. Thanks a lot. I'll let you go. And all right. I'll probably post this probably Monday, and I'll send you the link.
Okay. Thank you.
Take it easy. Enjoy your evening. Bye bye.
You too.